BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As 11,000 servicemen are sacked and aircraft carriers, Harriers and Nimrods are broken up, are we seeing democracy and revolution in Libya or the opening shots of World War III? We ask, might we soon need our armed forces like never before? And we test the rumours that a US company called VeriChip has developed human microchips, which they want to use to replace money if the global economy collapses. But first, the latest on our regional environment from Mike Birkin and Friends of the Earth in the Southwest. Hi, Mike, and welcome
Hello,
to Drive Time.
Tony.
Now, fuel prices, £160 on your family holiday. Travel giants are imposing fuel surcharges on sunshine breaks. Now, I suppose we've got lobbying from Friends of the Earth to blame for this.
I don't think they've actually done this in response to any green lobbying. We, after all, have been telling them for some time that aviation is getting off far too lightly when it comes to taxation, and it hasn't made much difference. So this is just a straightforward response to economic forces that are making cut price air travel that much harder for the companies to offer. And obviously, fuel prices are partly at the base of this, but you know, the cut price air travel business has been a cutthroat business for some time, and they're feeling the pressure, and putting the prices up is one of the things they have to do to respond to it.
Now, I suppose when people are filling up their cars with petrol or diesel, this is one of the times when they're not really on side with Friends of the Earth, because sometimes now, I mean, we're talking about 80, even £90 to fill your car up with fuel.
Yeah. I don't think that what we've been saying over the years, really, if we'd been listened to a little bit more, things might be a bit less painful now.
Do you think we're just too dependent on our cars?
We're too dependent on fossil fuels, cheap energy, full stop. And the way that has worked in the past is basically just through economic forces. It has led to it being more expensive to insulate your house than to pay the fuel bill. It's not incentivized people to buy fuel-efficient cars or to think about how they travel. It's led to companies centralizing their distribution because the transport was cheap, and all the economic signals have always led us down this direction, which has now locked us into a dependency on cheap fuel. And basically, if governments had planned ahead rather better and figured out that cheap fuel wasn't going to last forever, we might have been a little bit better insulated, a bit cushioned against these shocks now.
Is there anything that car drivers can do to actually reduce the amount of fuel they're using? It's not easy, is it? Because you kind of get into the habit. It's a bit like, you know, using the gas central heating or whatever. When the gas prices were lower, you're in the habit of using that fossil fuel, as if it was as cheap as it used to be.
Well, I mean, there is advice that fairly straightforward advice that motorists can take to reduce fuel consumption. You know, just, you know, kind of regularly keeping the tyre pressures checked up, not carrying excess weight, and accelerating and braking as little as possible, driving in as high a gear as you possibly can.
Having a look in the boot, you're saying, essentially, and seeing if there's anything doesn't need to be in there.
Yeah, are your deck chairs still in the boot from the beach holiday last summer? But I mean, you know, that actually, and it sounds a bit silly, but those few things are going to sort of save a few percentage on fuel bills.
And also, I suppose, being a little bit gentler on the accelerator.
Yeah, that's the thing that makes the biggest difference of all. I don't own a car, but I hire a car, and I really love it when I get one of those ones that actually shows you the fuel consumption on the dash, and you can try hypermiling, you know, try and keep that needle that shows the fuel consumption as low as you possibly can. It's quite fun, and you can really sort of appreciate how your driving technique makes a big difference to fuel consumption.
Yeah, and braking a little bit less, or maybe use engine braking, or at least something just to keep the fuel consumption down. But anyway, Martin, this isn't really really going to solve the macroeconomic problem here, is it? So what's happening with that?
Well, I mean, as Prime Minister Putin said last week, it looks like we're going to $200
for... He's a president.
He's a president. Of course, his Prime Minister is Medvedev. He said we're going to $200 for a barrel of oil. That's where we're going.
Because this is rather annoying, isn't it? I mean, you see that there's a well, I say annoying because, you know, you think, well, the whole thing with Iraq was, you know, to the idea partly, if there's anything positive come out of it, it's to keep the price of oil down. And now we're seeing the price of oil going shooting up, even despite Iraq.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's going to happen is the oil price is basically set in a futures market. So it's about fear. It's not about supply and demand. And I can't see in any realistic way that people are not going to recognise that the Middle East is going to be in turmoil. We're not quite sure what's going to happen, but blimey, it's definitely going to be in turmoil. And the oil prices, we're definitely going to have a double-dip recession. The cuts that the government have brought in were obviously stupid in my own view anyway, but even if we had a new Labour government trying to do things sensibly, a $200 oil price for a barrel is going to knock it all
that
on
is
head.
Actually, Mike, and sure you do quite a lot positive for the environment, a very high oil price like that, doubling the present oil price, isn't it? Because it's going to force us out of our cars.
It's going to force changes, but what amount of pain is going to be felt along the way to do that? Because I mean, food prices follow fuel prices, so you know we're going to be having a lot of pressure on households and individuals on the lower income levels, and this is a really the big challenge that governments have failed to live up to is how we're going to make the transition to a lower fossil fuel, lower resource intensive economy in such a way that actually the damage doesn't fall on those who are least able to bear it.
Okay, moving on, we hear that the climate camp, this is in Wednesday's Guardian, the climate camp, there will be no camp for the climate activists this year. After 5 years of camps, composting toilets, vegan curry and run-ins with the police, the climate camp is calling it a day. The decision follows a five-day meeting, crikey, what a meeting, to reach a consensus. In a statement, activists for the climate movement said the camp was being disbanded to leave room to launch new radical experiments to tackle the intertwined ecological, social and economic crises we face. Well, I wonder, one aspect of this, Mike, is that maybe they've actually been successful in bringing climate change onto the agenda, and that may be why they're thinking, well, it's time to move on.
Well, I mean it's certainly been helpful in bringing climate change up the agenda, but I think also there comes a time when you recognize as a fleet-footed movement that the tactics that you've been using over a number of years, you know, the opposition has got used to you trying to have a climate camp, so they're ready to deal with that. So go and try something different, be one step ahead of the game.
So what next, if it's not necessarily the climate issue, what do you think, what other environmental issues are the activists likely to be looking at next?
Well, I don't think they're saying that the climate issue is one that's gone away for them, but they're looking at the way in which that interrelates with other things. So you've got, for example, now and one of the sort of attempts that has been made to deal with the climate issue has been an increasing reliance on using biofuels. Now, this is actually a kind of bogus solution. It's an extremely destructive industry. So And it's that too is having a knock-on effect on food prices. So maybe protesters will focus in on particular aspects of what the government is trying to do in order to negotiate its way out of the crises.
So does Friends of the Earth sign up to all this stuff about coal being evil and dangerous for the environment? Because there's a lot of people also very cynical about this, saying, well, actually, coal is a staple energy supply of Britain. It's natural, it's here, we don't have to import it if we don't want to.
Coal's one, in terms of its damage to the climate, coal is, you know, the dirtiest fuel there is, or the grades of coal. But it's possible that you could find ways, for instance, of using coal to develop hydrogen-based fuels and capture and store the carbon. That is something that we wouldn't rule out, and then the coal resources that we have will be very helpful for us. but it ain't going to be cheap.
The other thing, of course, is that it's very much associated with Thatcherism in the 1980s and the 70s, the coal strikes, and actually as a sort of political, I mean, a lot of miners and people who were sympathetic with the miners at the time saw this as a very much a political move to actually crush the power of the unions rather than to, you know, as any kind of economic thing, saying that the coal wasn't economic, because there's, you know, decades still of coal under the ground.
Yes, yes, that's, I think there's little doubt that that is true. And it's ironic that it actually, the closure of Britain's coal industry, coal-fired power stations and what's called the Dash for Gas, substituting gas-fired power stations for coal-fired, actually meant that we were able to point to a relatively good environmental performance. For example, at the time of the negotiating the Kyoto Agreement, Britain was able to say, oh, look at us, we're squeaky clean, we've done all this stuff to reduce our carbon emissions, but actually that was a lot to do with exporting heavy industry and to do with closing down coal power stations.
Well, let's just have a little a last look back at this article, because they're giving at least an indication in The Guardian here about where the activists may be going. Increasingly, apparently, the climate campers have become involved in new movements such as the student occupations, the forest sell-off campaign, which is apparently successful, Palestinian solidarity groups and the national anti-cuts movement. Francis Wright from the camp's legal team said of the school walkouts last year, the girl who organised the walkout at my daughter's school had been a climate camp that summer. People who have been to camp know how to organise. They have the skill set. Now I think you can see the impact all over the country. Activist Mel Evans is looking forward to what happens next. Climate camp was always about more than just climate change. It's also about the political and economic context for climate change. And people from climate camp are now addressing those issues through UK Uncut and dozens of other campaigns. It may not be called climate camp anymore, but the methods and the values will carry on. So it sounds as if there's a whole lot of spin-off, really, from these climate camps. Have you actually ever been to one yourself? Can you just describe what a climate camp's like, Mike?
I haven't been to a climate camp. I've been to the Big Green Gathering, which, you know, had certain similarities, although not so strictly focused on just one particular aim.
Yeah, it's a great pity that that isn't happening anymore.
Well,
In fact, I did a little documentary on why the last one was closed down by sort of nefarious reasons.
Yes.
By, I think it was Mendip District Council and the police combined to sort of stop it happening, basically. That's a real pity. So I mean, I've actually been to one of these, and this was at King's North Power Station, and I just found it, it's really like a sort of something slightly hippie-ish about it, but also educational, so a bit of everything. So there's a lot of leaflets, kind of lectures and talks going on all sorts of different subjects. And why is it that we have to resort to these sort of methods to actually educate? I mean, surely, you know, we could be using TV, radio, newspapers to actually educate people like this about these climate issues.
Well, there's only so far mainstream media wants to go, isn't it? Because it is a very challenging proposition that we've got to change the economy so radically, and we've got to do so in a way that recognises social justice. And that's something that mainstream media isn't particularly comfortable about dealing with, and I think this learning through activism is just a brilliant response to it.
Now, the localism bill. Now, I know that Friends of the Earth have had a good look through all the legislation that the Conservatives are bringing in, and they've got their fingers crossed that this localism bill is actually going to be something quite positive. Can you just tell us what it is?
Well, we think there are some positive cherries that you can pick out of that pudding of the localism bill. And we've got the Bristol group is holding its next public meeting, which is on first Tuesday in April. That's the 5th of April. It'll be in the YHA down on the harbour side. And we are featuring in that meeting a couple of sort of Bristol entrepreneurs, if you like, but they're social entrepreneurs, people who are seeking to develop new ventures, including, for instance, the idea of a tram for South Bristol, but do so, you know, not on the conventional model of either being a large privately owned company like First Group that comes in and develops the transport network purely for profit, or it being municipally or state owned, but actually a social enterprise that can run transport systems run by Bristol for Bristol.
But what is I mean, social enterprise sounds nice, right? But what
does,
is it like a charity or something?
Well, it's an alternative model of economic organisation, where it's a company that is run in some respects like a conventional company, but the profits don't go to private shareholders, they go back into the company, and and help to develop whatever it is that it's doing.
This is one of the things that always annoys me when things get privatised, because you just know you've got at least two, if not more, but at least two bunches of people taking money out of what used to be a nationalised. I mean, for example, with the railways, that kind of thing, and the buses. You've always got a few fat cat bosses on their six-figure salaries taking money out of the system that used to be run as a public service. You've also then got the shareholders taking out. So what you're saying is this would actually get rid of some of that, would it? And you know, so the shareholders wouldn't be extracting a kind of a pound of flesh for every ticket on the bus and every person that went on it.
You could be a shareholder in a social enterprise, but with the understanding that the return you're going to get on it is pretty small, and basically the purpose of your being a shareholder is to have a share in providing a better service for the place where you live.
But surely,
energy or whatever.
Somebody like First Bus is going to be able to attract the investment, whereas a little company like that isn't.
Well, sometimes the smaller companies can be more, move quicker, be more entrepreneurial, do things that First Bus wouldn't do. First Bus has got lots of different irons in lots of different fires. They provide big public transport operations all over the country. Maybe they're not that interested in investing in Bristol. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we've got such a poor public transport service in this city compared to many others. They're not that, and they don't have a loyalty to Bristol. Their first loyalty by law is to their shareholders. That's what private companies like that are actually set up legally to do.
Now, okay, so just remind us, why is the localism bill an interesting bill?
Because it allows a greater possibility of groups of people taking on services and property and things that were previously owned by local authorities other government bodies.
And when's your meeting?
It's the 5th of April, and it's down at the Harbourside, YHA.
Now, where do we find Friends of the Earth on the internet and on the telephone, Mike?
The telephone is not the most reliable way of contacting us. So go for it. Come meet us at the public meeting, or go for the internet, which is just www.bristolfo.org.uk.
Mike Birkin from Bristol or South West Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us. Now, Martin, we'd like to have a chat with you now about Libya and other things. Mm-hmm. Libya, apparently, as we're told, is not helped. This is an article in The Guardian. It's not helped by the prism of propaganda. Media talk of tank battles and sweeping bombers is inflating an already serious illusion with dangerous consequences, according to Peter Beaumont in The Guardian on Thursday. That's yesterday, this week. In the town of Zawiya last week, which is supposed to be called the key town of Zawiya, as it has become, a few hours of skirmishes that left a handful of dead was transformed via the prism of propaganda into a confrontation between two sides armed with tanks. I've read of helicopter attacks on civilians in neighbourhoods of the capital, the bombing on outlying towns, yet for now, at least, I have not found any evidence of it. It's true, too, that there have been more serious clashes in the east of the country and air raids witnessed by my colleague Martin Chulov. But still, there is much about this narrative that does not feel real. I read, for example, that Gaddafi is dug into his last stronghold of Tripoli with the rebels advancing on every front. Yet when I drive out into the towns around Tripoli, I find a very different picture. Anyway, so Martin, do you think that there's, as is being suggested here by Peter Beaumont in The Guardian yesterday, that there is a bit of propaganda going on in the Western treatment of what's going on in Libya, what is effectively now becoming a civil war?
Well, I mean, in any war, truth is the first casualty. And we, sitting in this studio today, we're not really in a position to say what's going on in Libya. We haven't the faintest idea.
We did have a report, direct report.
The idea that the Libyan Air Force was bombing civilians has clearly been debunked, has it not? And what it looks like is this was a story being run by the Western press in order to force a no-fly zone. But I would also say that it's very difficult to assess, sitting here, what is going on in Libya. You know, I'm not sitting here saying I know what's going on in Libya,
well,
nor should you.
We had advice from Mohammed al-Haddad, who's born in Libya, and his family are all out there. He was saying, basically, just speak to Libyans directly on the telephone. The other thing is, of course, that the critical reporting is starting to come out now, so that there are these sorts of contrary reports saying, well, actually, things may be not quite so clean-cut as we were at first told.
Well, I mean, things are never clean cut, and I'm trying to follow it in real time as you are, Tony, but I wouldn't like to say that I know what's going on. It's a very complicated situation. There's a lot of people dying as we speak.
Well, the background to it, of course, is that there's been a campaign against the Libyans for many years here in Britain, and last September, on the 9th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, former MI5 counter-subversion officer Annie Machon was asked to speak in New York, and one of the topics she chose to discuss was Libya.
There were the two cases of false flag terrorism, and these were the cases that made my ex-partner and I quit and decide to go public and blow the whistle on MI5. And the first one was the bombing of the Israeli embassy in London in 1994. Now, in this case, two Palestinian students were arrested, and they were tried and convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison each for conspiring to cause this explosion. And yet MI5 had information that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, had actually bombed its own embassy. And it had done that for two reasons. One was to increase security around all the Israeli assets in London. They were always hassling for it, and MI5 was always saying, no, there's not a threat. But they also wanted to shatter a Palestinian political support network, which was operating in London at the time, which these two students belonged to. And the lead investigator in MI5, whose code number was, his sort of James Bond number was G91, had seen all the evidence and all the intelligence, and he made that official assessment that Mossad had done this. And the second case was the real case that made us quit. This was the case of MI6 funding the assassination attempt against Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. Now, they did this illegally, outside political control. They didn't get prior permission to do this. And they paid about $100,000 to a group of Islamic extremist terrorists, as they were called in those days. Now, of course, we all call it Al-Qaeda, to try and assassinate Gaddafi. Now, obviously, it went wrong. But, of course, innocent people ended up getting hurt, not only when the explosion occurred, but also in the ensuing security shootout. I think in total, 11 innocent people died that day because MI6 became a state sponsor of terror. So what can you do when you're working in an agency like that? In the UK, we have a law called the Official Secrets Act. So if you ever talk to anyone ever about what you saw when you were working there, you go to prison, not the people who conspired to commit murder. So we left and we went on the run, and we ended up living in exile for 3 years because we decided to report the crimes of the spies. And I was arrested, family members were arrested, friends, supporters, journalists. Some were arrested, some were even convicted for trying to help us in this process. And of course, David Shaler went to prison not once but twice for blowing the whistle on murder on the part of MI6.
Isn't it interesting that in actual fact the British intelligence services have a long-standing relationship with Islamic terrorist groups, going back to the 1980s, the 1990s? We could say it's fascinating, but it's also horrifying, isn't it? That's the reality.
I mean, this is what we're really saying here is that the British intelligence services have, in the past, have tried to bump Gaddafi off. You know, this is without getting any kind of political, parliamentary, or government approval for it.
No, but I mean, what people have got to understand is that the Operation Cyclone, which was the CIA's operation to support the jihadi terrorists in Afghanistan, was run by Robert Gates, who is currently the US Secretary of State for Defense. He was in charge of the CIA during that period. He is a criminal. He should be in prison. Not only is he not in prison, he's in power. It's absolutely outrageous.
Now, every week, US historian Webster Tarpley hosts his World Crisis radio show, and we'll be having to listen to that in a minute. But before we do that, a website called Global Research, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, says the US is preparing an invasion of Libya to seize control of its oil reserves. In Caracas, this is just a couple of days ago, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said Monday that he won't condemn Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi And he warned that the United States is preparing an invasion of the North African country to seize control of its oil reserves. We must be prudent, he says. We know what our political line is. We don't support invasions or massacres or anything like that, no matter who does it. A campaign of lies is being spun together regarding Libya, said Chavez in a televised speech to a crowd of graduates who had just received diplomas from state universities. Now, do you think Chavez is just being a bit nutty here, Martin? Is he out of line?
Well, frankly, Fidel Castro said very similar things, and I think that it's wrong. Gaddafi is a dictator. Chavez is an elected politician. He's won 11 elections in his country, and I think it's a bit of a shame that he is taking this view. And I'm not saying that we know what's going on in Libya. We don't. It's a very complicated situation. There's lots of nasty things going on. We don't trust the West. We don't trust the Israelis. We don't trust the Americans. But on the other hand, people have got a right to live in a free country. And if they're fighting to live in that free country, Chavez ought to just support them, frankly.
I mean, he's got a bit of a reputation, Gaddafi, hasn't he, for a secret police and a similar kind of thing to Mubarak, but maybe not quite so bad in Libya. Also, there are things like the child mortality rates, death rates in Libya are some of the best in Africa.
Well, Libya is actually a welfare state. And people are actually better off in Libya. There's only 8 million people in Libya and they've got lots of oil. So in actual fact, as long as you behave yourself and do as you're told, you will be looked after by the Libyan state, just like the Bahraini state. But on the other hand, there are things more important than money, and freedom is more important than money.
So do you think that maybe that this backlash against Gaddafi has really fueled it himself by having such a draconian secret police over there?
Well, Gaddafi has been set up to be a bogeyman by the Western intelligence services over many years, as you and I both know. He is actually a kind of look over here, this is, look at what's happening here, Gaddafi. Gaddafi was the Osama bin Laden before Osama bin Laden. And what people have got to remember is that these so-called extremists that are our enemies are being set up to be our enemies. Gaddafi is very close to Berlusconi. Blair was kissing him on the cheek. These people are not to be thought of as revolutionaries. I'm really rather disappointed in somebody like Hugo Chavez, who is a very responsible and respectable leader. He shouldn't be giving Gaddafi any.
I mean, we haven't actually set up Gaddafi at all, because he took over himself all those years ago when royal family were actually out of the country doing some medical operation, and that's when he took over. So we didn't set that up.
Well, you're going to have Webster on in a minute. Webster Tarpley, I understand. It's pretty well understood that Gaddafi's coup in 1969 was probably an MI6 operation. That's pretty well understood.
Who by?
By MI6. Gaddafi is like a puppet. He's a puppet of the Western intelligence services.
I think he would be rather irritated to hear you say that, and he would deny it completely.
He would, but then what's his Mandy Rice Davis said? He would say that, wouldn't he?
So, yes, back to Webster Tarpley, and every week he hosts his World Crisis Radio show on the internet, and he should know all about the crisis. He's author of George H.W. Bush, an unauthorised biography, which charts the Bush dynasty's former involvement with the Nazis right through to the present day. But what does he make of the wider implications of the present crisis in the Middle East and in North Africa?
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Keep up with everything at Tarpley.net. Posted today on Tarpley.net, my essay on Egypt. Why was Mubarak toppled? Mubarak was toppled because he was opposing the U.S. plan for a war with Iran. The U.S. plan had been to assemble the Sunni Arab states, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and others, the Emirates and the Gulf, into a united front together with the Israelis under a U.S. nuclear umbrella, and then play them against Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the radical Shiites across the Middle East. Mubarak was saying no to that recipe for World War III. Therefore, he had to go. The Golden Youth were therefore dupes of an operation that has brought war closer. And the departure of Mubarak determined significantly by a threat to the Suez Canal. That's seemingly what got him to leave, although we need to get somewhat more on that. It's looking certain that that was at least part of the package. Now, and also keep up on Twitter, Webster G. Tarpley, Webster G. Tarpley, all lowercase, all one word, Webster G. Tarpley. On Twitter, keep up hour to hour on this breaking stuff.
So, the revolutionaries in Egypt, not revolutionaries at all, according to Tarpley, but dupes. Do you think that's at all possible?
Well, the CIA and the Mossad are trying to influence these revolutions. Of course they are. So are MI6. They're sticking their finger in. But that doesn't mean that the ordinary people haven't got their demands and their agenda. The revolutionary things are revolutionary.
I mean, but looking from a US point of view and from a CIA point of view, they're looking in maybe to Egypt. At least this is what Tarpley's saying here. And they're saying, well, actually, what they've done is they've created a tension deliberately between the president and the people, where the people are being divided into rich and poor, and that creates a tension. And this is actually suits the US to come in and actually topple Mubarak at a certain point, just for convenience's sake, because there's that tension been set up historically. The other thing, of course, is the creation of the boundaries of all these Middle Eastern countries, many of them, are quite artificial and have been created sort of decades ago, often by the British Empire, certainly by European empires who were in there, for this very purpose of actually dividing people against one another so they can come in later and exploit the situation.
Well, that's all absolutely true, Tony, but at the same time, revolutions are revolutions. When ordinary people go out to fight for what they believe in, it's not entirely controlled by whoever, by the imperialist powers, by anybody. Ordinary people have their demands, and that's clearly what we're seeing here. It's a moment of great hope, but also of great sadness, because a lot of people have died in the last few weeks.
So what do you think is going to be happening in Libya? It seems already the beginnings of a civil war between Gaddafi and his supporters in the west of Libya and his opponents, the opposition, in the oil-rich east of Libya.
Well, the National Council of Libya, I think it was on Sunday, made a statement saying that they didn't want any outside intervention. And what I would like to see in Libya is a quick victory for the revolutionary forces, quickly. But that's not necessarily going to be the case. Well, you know, people are obviously fighting and dying, and it's very easy for us to sit in this studio and have an opinion about it, but it's all very sad, isn't it?
One final article, which came out 2 days ago again on this global research website by David Rothscum, and his website is davidrothscum.blogspot.com. How was Libya doing under the rule of Gaddafi? How bad did the people have it? Were they oppressed, as we now commonly accept as fact? Let's look at the facts for a moment. Before the chaos erupted, Libya had a lower incarceration rate than the Czech Republic. It ranked at 61st in the world. Libya had the lowest infant mortality rate in the whole of Africa. It had the highest life expectancy of all in Africa. Less than 5% of the population was undernourished. In response to the rising food prices around the world, the government of Libya abolished all taxes on food. The people in Libya were rich. Libya had the highest gross domestic product at purchasing power parity per capita of the whole of Africa. So why should people who are doing very, very well, why should they rise up against Gaddafi?
Because money is not the only thing. Freedom is very important. The freedom to have a radio show like this and discuss things in an open way is a very precious thing. I prepare to have a much lower income as long as I've got the freedom to do that. That's the only thing worth fighting for.
Great Britain, it says in this article, funded an al-Qaeda cell in Libya, as we heard earlier, in an attempt to assassinate Gaddafi. The main opposition group in Libya now is the National Front for the Salvation of Libya. The opposition group is being funded by Saudi Arabia, the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and French intelligence. This group has unified itself with other opposition groups to become the National Conference for the Libyan Opposition. It was this organisation that called for a day of rage that plunged Libya into chaos on February the 17th this year. It did this in Benghazi, a conservative city that's always been opposed to Gaddafi's rule. It should be noted that the National Front for the Salvation of Libya is well armed. In 1996, the group tried to unleash a revolution in the eastern part of Libya before it used the Libyan National Army, the armed division of the NFSL, to begin this failed uprising. So this isn't really the first time people have tried to rise up, but it is worrying, isn't it, that apparently this organisation is being funded by the Saudis, the CIA and French intelligence, Martin?
Well, of course. I mean, this is a very messy business, is it not? Very messy business. And I just hope, as we sit here talking in our radio studio, I hope that people aren't dying as we speak, but of course they are, and we don't really understand why. It's a tragedy. And imperialism has got a lot to answer for, hasn't it?
Now, on to another part of the world, and this is Pakistan. A terribly embarrassing story, which has seen virtually no reporting on British television or in British newspapers, but is all over the newspapers and TV in Asia, who are quite rightly calling it the biggest story of the decade. His name is Raymond Davis. It's the Raymond Davis story. Several weeks ago, an agent from the private military company Blackwater shot dead two Pakistanis thought to be intelligence service or ISI officers who were following him. The US embassy tried to say he had diplomatic immunity, but it has since transpired that Blackwater agent Raymond Davis was working for the CIA and peddling nuclear bomb-making material and biological weapons to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. We did touch on this story briefly last week. Yeah. Editor of WhatReallyHappened.com, Mike Rivero, takes up the story.
The situation over in Pakistan with this Davis gentleman, who started out being reported as an embassy employee or official for the U.S. Embassy, then it came out that he actually worked for Blackwater Z. He is a CIA contract agent. And the story that is coming out now, courtesy of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, is that Davis, working for the Central Intelligence Agency, was attempting to pass nuclear bomb-making materials and biological weapons to Al-Qaeda. Now, you think about that for a minute. When you have a CIA agent trying to give Al-Qaeda nuclear bomb materials, where do you think it's headed? Remember, 2 weeks ago, we had this FBI official coming out and saying, oh, yes, it's a 100% probability that there'll be a nuclear bomb explosion here in the United States of America. And then we find out the CIA is trying to give Al-Qaeda a nuclear bomb. It's easy to make that kind of prediction when you know where the bombs are coming from. So it looks like the Pakistan ISI stumbled across the next 9/11 in progress. And this Davis shot two of their agents trying to get away. And they've got him now, and the U.S. wants him back, and they're willing to risk war with Pakistan to get him back, because if this Davis starts singing, and sooner or later he will, and it's on videotape and made public to the world, then we will have evidence that the U.S. government is planning a nuclear false flag in this country, or maybe in Europe, to try and kick off World War III, because they are that desperate to start a world war. They're giving nuclear weapons and biological agents to the guys we're all being taught we are supposed to be afraid of right now. This guy, Davis, was CIA. And the Pakistanis and the Russians are saying he was trying to give fissionable material to Al-Qaeda.
Now, Martin, can we trust the Russians on this one? It does look like the Russians and the Pakistanis are agreed that this guy was peddling weapons of mass destruction to Al-Qaeda, and he was being employed by the Americans.
Well, it's very interesting what Mike Rivera is saying there. That's a hardcore presentation of the facts. What I would say in a more measured way is that the educated classes in Pakistan, the people who read the English language newspapers, are very well aware that the CIA and MI6 are deep into terrorism in their country. And that's what moderate people believe. You know, we're not quite sure about what these allegations are about. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. But ordinary moderate people, doctors, lawyers, teachers, the educated classes, there's only a small sliver of the population. But if you read the Pakistani English language press, there's a tremendous suspicion that the Americans and the British are up to nonsense.
Well, you know what it reminds me of is the occasion when British special forces were found in Iraq with all sorts of
and in Basra.
arms and bomb grenades and this kind of thing, and then shot their way out in a shootout. This is what Raymond Davis tried to do.
Yeah.
He tried to shoot out the local police force, ISI, whoever it was, that were trying to actually arrest him. A similar kind of situation, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
only this time with biological weapons and fissionable material.
These are allegations about biological weapons and fissionable material. We're listening, but they're only allegations. But I think what ordinary people who live in the suburbs of Bristol have got to understand is that the Western intelligence services are terrorists, and educated people in Pakistan know this, and it's about time people did in this country.
An article, another one from Global Research: the US and NATO escalate the world's deadliest wars on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border. Staying with Pakistan, the US and military allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization have entered the third month of the war in Afghanistan this year, which President Barack Obama in December of 2009 announced as the year in which US and other occupation forces will be reduced, preparatory to their full withdrawal. But within months of these claims, Commander-in-Chief has over 90,000 troops in the conquered country, currently 60,000 more from some 50 other nations serving in NATO's International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF. Total number exceeds that of any foreign military force ever before stationed in Afghanistan. Now, it doesn't sound like, with this surge going on now, Martin, and apparently lots more drone attacks as well. The missile attacks conducted by the US CIA have killed, apparently, in the neighbourhood of 1,000 people just in 1 year, something like 9 or 10,000 people since this invasion of Afghanistan started. So it doesn't sound like they're going to be pulling out tomorrow. Where is this all heading?
Well, it's heading towards World War III, which is what you're hinting. There is a real possibility that we're going to lose control of this situation.
I mean, is the US actually at war with Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, they are in reality, but there's a kind of pretense that they're not. I mean, this guy who's just been arrested, Ray Davis, the Kinks, let's call him a Kink. This is a really serious deal breaker between the Pakistanis and the Americans. He shot two people dead at the traffic lights. You know, he's a criminal.
So the big question we're asking tonight, with 9/11 and 7/7 attacks in the West being used by the media and military industrial complex to justify stealing oil and other resources around the world, is this a new kind of world war against all independent-minded governments not dominated already by Western capital? Is that war gradually intensifying? Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey is part of Iraq Veterans Against the War, powerful pressure groups of serving soldiers and ex-servicemen based in the US. Back in November 2007 on Venezuelan television, he explained what he's been told in his United States Marine Corps intelligence briefings.
We will stay in Iraq until we bleed the Iraqis of all of their oil. And then we will move to Iran, Syria, and whoever else we think has oil or has natural resources that we can rape.
Do you think they would go so far as to take Venezuela's oil by force?
This is World War III. There are no rules. The rules went out the window September 11th.
Now that's Staff Sergeant, or former Staff Sergeant, Jimmy Massey there speaking on Venezuelan TV. Two questions for you, Martin. First, is he right? Is it World War III? And secondly, why aren't we hearing this kind of thing on our mainstream media here at all?
Well, we're not hearing it on the mainstream media because we are in a world war situation. I mean, it depends where you live, doesn't it? If you live in a poor community on the southern side of the planet, World War III started a long time ago. We've got the British Army in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Why aren't they protecting us? I mean, they're on the other side of the world. We're in a situation now where we're going to World War III. Slowly by degrees, yeah. It's like boiling a frog. You just turn the heat up 1 degree at a time, and people don't notice what's happening. But this is outrageous. As you said, 1,000 civilians have been killed by drone attacks in Pakistan in the last year. They've all got family. They've all got people who are crying and upset about them.
And this week, David Cameron has defended axing 11,000 jobs from our armed forces. And this is possibly including some troops on the front line in Afghanistan. It must be a bit irritating to be told you're going to be made redundant when you get home if you're fighting out in Afghanistan. The proposals come as the UK examines what military assets it can use to deal with the crisis in Libya. Last autumn's Strategic Defence Review set out plans for reducing the size of the army by 7,000, the Navy and RAF by 5,000, which is a total of 17,000. Some of that number will be met by not replacing people to retire or leave for other reasons. Now, I wonder, Martin, and of course there's a lot of other announcements this week about RAF Marham. That's 13 Squadron and 14 Squadron at Lossiemouth, will go on June the 1st this year as well. Is this the right time to be doing this? Because I can't imagine the Labour government getting away with this.
Well, it's funny because the Labour defence spokesperson, whose name I've forgotten, is saying that we must keep a strong defence, or, you know, he's playing the Tory card. I mean, in actual fact, America is bankrupt. They're trying to fight wars on the other side of the planet, but the dollar's about to collapse. And when the Taliban know, they're fighting until the dollar collapses, and it's going to collapse, and then America's going to lose the war. Just as they lost in Vietnam, they're going to lose in Afghanistan. It's a big mess.
So is it one of the reasons we're having all the financial trouble in this country? We're trying to do unsustainable wars abroad?
Well, it's very interesting. There was a Pentagon report this week about the financial crisis was caused by Islamic terrorists, which is a joke, absolute joke. The US
the reason we're out in Afghanistan is to stop these terrorists, isn't it?
Is it? I think it's more to do with pushing the Chinese, occupying an oil pipeline. We're playing the great game. It's the same old, same old. It's a disgrace and an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars.
Now, the group is called #Jan25, which refers to the Twitter accounts used to get people together for the uprisings in Tahrir Square in Cairo, in Egypt. It's from the US, and so here's a song dedicated to the overthrow of Egypt's Hosni Mubarak.
First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong, it ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Bu Azizi lit the hoof. And it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis, the new moon shines bright as the man's spoon was as mass as the man writes in the spell room. As a disunity communally removing the tumors, rotten rumors. We're making headway, chanting down the dictators, getting rid of dead weight. Opening the floodgates like the streets of Jeddah. But why but to throw them off to whomever answered the lie. We've been empowered to speak, and though the future is uncertain, man, at least it isn't bleak. When our children can be raised not in a cage but on a peak, the inheritors of Mother Earth are meek. Freedom isn't given by oppressors, it's demanded by oppressed. Freedom lovers, freedom fighters, free to gather and protest for the God-given rights, for a freedom of the press. We know freedom is the answer. The only question is,
who's next?
It's very bad for my government. I haven't food, I haven't anything. Me and my children, I will die today.
Time to push, we ain't falling back now. Time to fight, we are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups? Trying to keep a lookout for better days. Time to push, we ain't falling back now. Time to fight, we are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups?
Storm, pleasure to be born. News media disseminated. Heaven's gate, level of alarm. Third person dictate. Couldn't sever him till dawn. 3 mil in the street, we will live in peace. But first, God rest the soul of those who choose to be free. From poverty, they rose, knee deep in robbery. Souls will plummet and burn like Muhammad Waziz. And just see the logos. Deliver the state, now here's his own soul. Karma waits for no man. Your presidential charm and armor break out of place in your own homeland. Now hip like Mezza. Imagine a million human march to Gaza. From Qahira to Baghdad, siyaset hum sahira. Alamat al-akhira.
Time to push, we ain't falling back now. Time to fight, cause we are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups? Trying to keep a lookout for better days. Time to push, we ain't falling back now. Time to fight, cause we are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups? Trying to keep a lookout.
And that's where the beef ends. You should learn a lesson from oppression where it begins. Black, white, yellow, it don't matter what race. Before you break us, you gon' push us off the deep end. Different countries, same struggle, we even. Contemplate on squeezing when our kids ain't eating. Only upper differences is hot all year round there. Wintertime and your kids ain't freezing. But we all starving, all grieving. And the people with the power ain't got hard enough to feed us. I follow the procedures and I study my Quran. This is modern day science, we just waiting on Jesus. You should be the teacher of Quran to your kids instead of wasting time watching Kelly Ripa and Regis. This is Egypt, home of the ruins. Last time we needed change, it took Musa to move them. Operation get rid of the Pharaoh. Now we getting rid of who ain't willing to share no bread with the people. We are all equal. True men of God fear God, don't fear no person that's walking on the face of the earth. If you got a tank, knife, gun, bow, or an arrow, long as there's breath, then there's still hope left. So let hope rise like the eye of a sparrow.
Time to push, we ain't falling back now. Time to fight. We are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups? Trying to keep a lookout for better days. Time to push, now we ain't falling back now. Time to fight, we are all we have now. Do you hear me calling out for backups? Trying to keep a lookout for better days.
Won't be just niggas. this wimpy just speaks. A-Raps pack these rednecks and hicks. Leaders ain't helping them feeding the kids. The leaders helping pigs eating the kids. Back on my Elijah eating the liver. Run up in the White House with keys to the crib. The House and the Senate ousted in a minute. Take these streets to Wall Street, this one's for Kemet. They on that Gandhi, they on that Chato. Put that J to my Cairo Fuego. Hard for the press to find a scapegoat when every man, woman, child's at the table. They think they John Adams, they think they Ben Franklin. They want democracy, with them Arabs thinking. World leaders now can see when keep people from eating, the people will eat them.
Time to push, we ain't falling back now.
That is a hip-hop song for the Egyptian Revolution. The band is called #Jan25, which refers to the Twitter accounts used to get people together for the Egyptian uprisings. Now, to rumours that a US company called VeriChip has developed human microchips which they want to replace money if the global economy collapses. Now, here's a controversial story for you. Catherine Albrecht has been reading, writing and campaigning on supermarket cards, that is the little Tesco, Sainsbury card type things, the Nectar cards, and private databases, which allow data about us to be sold all over the world to the highest bidder. But she revealed in New York last September the nefarious activities of a company called VeriChip. Now, VeriChip have developed a sophisticated microchip which they've developed to be implanted into humans. So let's have a listen to Catherine Albrecht's speaking last year, that's last September the 11th in New York.
It's estimated that about 90% of American families now routinely scan a supermarket card, in other words, a numbered ID card, in order to buy food in this country. So back in 1999, I became concerned about that, and I became an activist over that issue, and I started doing some research into these databases. And what I found has led me now, 11 years later, to what I do today. So there's two places where I think these databases are extraordinarily important, and where they tie in with new technologies that make it even easier to add to them and to create extraordinarily detailed information about people. This is not an end, this is a means. The end is control. Ultimately, if you want to have a society that is locked down and controlled, where meetings like this, for example, could be carefully monitored, then you need to be able to create the technology to keep an eye on your population. Now, Stalin understood this very well. In the Soviet Union, they had a very complex and sophisticated apparatus for observing who was falling outside of the government-accepted norms, and we're creating some very similar things in this country today. I've worked on RFID, that's radio frequency identification microchips. I've protested the use of RFID in retail establishments. I've worked on it on a corporate level. I've testified and introduced legislation around the country. And I've also worked on the issue of implantable RFID tags, or the VeriChip. And it was in part my work with the Associated Press that revealed the fact that those microchip implants cause cancer. So we have recently, and one victory we can celebrate, is we've actually seen the discontinuation of anyone commercially marketing implantable microchips as a result. So we've got some good news there. Thank you. And in fact, just to put that in perspective, a couple of years ago, 2007, the VeriChip Corporation, which manufactures and markets those implantable human microchips, was trading at, I think it was between $11 and $13 a share. They had a contract to implant microchips, you know, on a trial basis in people who were in Hackensack, New Jersey. So they were actively implanting people with microchips to manage their electronic medical records. Frankly, I was getting a little bit scared in 2007. With the microchip implants really rolling out. We did a protest down in West Palm Beach, Florida, against the implantation of 200 Alzheimer's patients at a community care center down there, a daycare center for Alzheimer's, had run a trial, or a, they called it a medical study, but they didn't have any medical oversight for it. So anyway, all of that has been discontinued. People have had their microchips removed. Blue Cross Blue Shield quietly canceled their trial. And as far as I know, no one is being chipped today. So that's the good news. And in case you'd like to learn more about that, antichips.com is our website for all of the research and information. We do sort of a meta overview of all of the research studies showing that when you put an implantable microchip into laboratory animals, that between 1% and 10% of those animals develop fast-growing malignant tumors, in other words, cancer, around those microchips. So I would encourage you to check that out. That's at antichips.com. That's also where we have an 80-question FAQ on virtually everything I know about implantable microchips. So that's a great resource if you'd like to check out that information.
Now, Martin, this is an interesting one, isn't it? And it's rather good news that they've actually stopped these things being used. Particularly, I was quite disgusted to hear that there's a medical study without proper medical records being kept of Alzheimer's patients implanting these microchips into Alzheimer's patients.
Well, obviously, we need protections against this kind of abuse of power. But at the same time, I think people have got to realise that it's very important not to be intimidated by the state. Not to be intimidated by microchips or photographs or anything else. The state would like us to be scared, and we mustn't be.
Okay. Now, do you think this is something that we might see here in Britain? I heard that there's some guy at Reading University who's volunteered to have microchips. We think of chips for dogs, but not for humans. What about you? Do you think if it was a good reason, would you have one?
This is a diversion from what I think is important. Tony Geraghty's book, The Irish War, he talks about the electronic cage, and the Republican community have lived in an electronic cage for 30 years. Microchips, photographs, helicopters, but of course they still knew what to do and to get on with it, and also to make peace at the end of it. You shouldn't be scared about these things.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour. That's Lib Dem Councillor for Lockleys, Guy Portney. And to our reporter, Marina Morris, and of course to our resident Old Labour economist, Martin Summers. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan, a report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, evidence of Masonic corruption in the police, an extended interview with the managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, an investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as our fifth anniversary investigation into the 7/7 London bombings of 2005. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. A podcast of this show is usually available online by midnight after broadcast. Don't forget, you can just go to the BCFM website, which is bcfm.org.uk, and click on Friday Drive Time on the right hand side if that's easier for you. Well, that's enough talk for tonight, as Friday night is music night. Top of the bill at 10, it's Mash Up to the Weekend by Sam, DJ Spungard. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Please do join us for Friday Drive Time next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.
93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.